This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, broadcasting locally on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York, and streaming globally online at WGXC.org. And I'm your host, Chad Weckler.
Lucinda Abra.
And Maria Cloje-Zincio.
Our two wonderful guests here in the Hudson studio. Both are regional artists, one on one side of the Hudson River, one on the other side. And Maria, you're on
the Columbia County side.
Columbia County. And
right.
What kind of artist are you?
I'm an encaustic artist, and that is encaustic art is working with wax, beeswax. And I've been an encaustic artist for about 5 years now. I've always been an artist all my life, but encaustic art is relatively new to me. And I took that medium on, like I said, 5 years ago, and then integrated that into my art world, which I'm doing right now. So
what is encaustic?
Encaustic comes from the Greek word encaustikos, correct? And it means to burn in. So you're working with melted wax, and you're working with actually layering different layers of wax on your art, fusing each layer so that it becomes archival. My work, I work with actually mixed media. I work with the wax, I work with found objects, I work with oils, and I incorporate all of that into my piece. It's whatever inspires me, whatever it is that I'm working with and how it's going to be created. Because encaustic, the wax has a sculpting effect too, and when it has a luminosity about it too. So it allows you the freedom to sculpt, to paint, and that's profound to me.
What's the origin of the wax?
The origin of the wax as far as beeswax is concerned? Okay, well, I'm going to add another piece to this. I am a beekeeper, and the origin of the wax comes from beeswax. And actually, I have 16 hives right now. I've been a beekeeper for about 6 years. So it comes from the hives of the bees, and actually after extraction, you have the leftover residue of wax that a lot of candle makers will take, okay. A lot of people who make soaps will, beeswax soaps will take, and that, when you clean the wax, when you extract the honey, and you have the very light wax combs from it that's left over, you take that and clean it, and you begin the process of either candle making, soap making, or being an encaustic artist. So my wax comes from my hives for the most part.
And Lucinda, you're also doing encaustics now.
I am indeed right now doing encaustics. I do not raise my own bees, although I admire that you do. And I have some questions about that I'll get to in a minute. It started, I've been an artist since I was 3 years old and found my grandfather's paint set. I was a little girl. I found this wooden box in the basement. I dragged it up the stairs. My mother was wearing a little gingham dress, washing dishes, and I kept yanking. I remember it very clearly, yanking on her. And she turned around. She said, "What?" And I said, "What is this?" She said, "Where did you find that?" My grandfather had died when my mother was 8. So that box had been sitting like in storage forever. So I said, Can I have it? And she opened the box, and the smell just entered me. It was like I was entered by the spirit of paint, and I've been doing it ever since. I mean, she set up a still life, and she said, "You can have the paints if you can paint that still life."
Good for her.
The paint turned, the still life turned to soup, but I did get the painting done, so I won my paints, and I've been doing it ever since. In the last 4 years, I felt a little flat about my work, and I wanted to go in a new direction. I wanted to have fun again. So I started doing these collages, and they were really exciting to me. I actually talked to my mom, who has now passed away, and I said, I'm doing collages. And she said, "Like you did in second grade?" I said, yeah, sort of like that, only a little more sophisticated. So I started doing the collages, and they kept getting bigger and bigger, and people used them as posters, and they used them as CD covers. But what do you do with these? Mm. You know, whereas a painting is an acceptable form of art. I was like, what do I do with these little things on paper? And at the same time I was doing that, I've been experimenting with the encaustic, which I love. You know, we were talking off air about the smell in the air. So my studio smells like turpentine and this honeyed jewel called encaustic. So I started blowing them up, and then I started cutting those apart. And then basically what I do now is I have the form. I put a medium on the form. I paint on top of that. I cut the thing. They're quite large. And I make a pattern, like a dress pattern, because otherwise I won't remember everything. And then I put them in the encaustic. I fuse them onto the prepared wax surface. And then I start painting on top of that. I'm just having the greatest time. In fact, I'm going to be having a show of them November 15th at Nobo Gallery, which is at 558 Warren Street. And the show will be running till the 14th of December. The opening is from 4:30 to 7.
And that's in Hudson.
That is in Hudson itself.
Smack dab.
That's very exciting.
When you were talking about the collage work, how did you, to inform our listeners, how do you do collage? And has it changed from the very beginning when you started and to this process now?
Well, it's probably changed insofar that no book is sacred from me and no image is sacred from me. So I go to a lot of yard sales and library sales, and thankfully I have a lot of friends, so they give me things. And I just have so many sources. And, you know, like I have at the show, there's going to be a piece. It's called Aria, and it's... I did one called, originally a collage called The Water Muse. There's originally three muses. And the second muse was the muse who manifested through voice. So, of course, I thought of music right away. So I found an image of a person, I found a woman's head singing that I liked. But I didn't know what else to do. I couldn't find, so she sat on kind of a piece of paper all by herself. And for 2 years, I looked for the right elements to go with her. Until finally, I found everything. Actually, there's a piece of a Rembrandt painting that's in front of her now. And so that's how if you come into my studio, it looks a little crazy, I will admit, because there's scraps of paper everywhere. And now there are literally places where they are probably 5 inches thick, and they're color coded. So, you know, as far as the changing, I think the only thing that's really changed is I have more and more material. And that's a little bit, remember that TV show Concentration?
Yes.
So it's a little bit like that, where you have to remember, where did you see that image? Because you'll put three things together, and per collage, I'll probably cut out 60 things and wind up using 30. So there's a point, right?
That's right.
Where you're almost unconsciously moving elements around, and then you're like, oh, if I just had that one corner in that specific chartreuse, and then you have to remember, where did I see that, or should I make it?
Right, exactly. I mean, I love working the same thing with collage. And one of my projects, which I'll talk about later, is a photo encaustic work. And it's a collage. It's all collage. And the beauty about working with material, you know, collage is if you make a mistake, you could just heat the wax and pull it out of there and start all over again. And that's the beauty. I know when I start a piece, and I'm sure you feel the same way, listen, when I start a piece, I'm thinking about it in my head, and you've got all these pieces out there. And sometimes you start to create it, and it just seems to start taking form. And then I see it in my, you know, my head, and then I see it on paper, and then I almost like a dream about it. It's a dreamy thing. So it's a lot of fun to work with collage. And then what I do with the collage is I continue painting like an oil painting. You know, I do photo encaustic, digital, you know, digital transfer. I print it on rice paper, and then I put it into the warm wax. And then I start to layer other pieces there, just like a collage. And then I take my encaustics, my colored mediums, and my pigment sticks, and I start to paint it as if it's an oil painting. And it becomes an oil painting, so that you can't always see where the collage is and where the real oil painting begins. It blends itself and it merges into each other. It's heavenly.
When the work is done, and obviously the wax is one of the major mediums of the artwork, do you put that artwork behind glass or you let it out in the open? And
not I.
No, you just, you know, the mummy cases were done with encaustic.
Right.
I mean, they're very sound. That medium is not going to move. It's not going to go anywhere. One of the beauties, as Maria was mentioning, is the luminosity of the material itself. And also, there's a depth. You can really see through the layers.
Yes.
And if you have it, I was just at the Dali Museum. And I was so frustrated because so much of that museum, the work is under glass. So as an artist, you know, when I go to a museum, there's material that I'm gathering, like what kind of brush and what materials and how fast was the brush stroke and which direction is it going to. And if glass is on top of it, I can't decipher everything. I get kind of frustrated. So one of the great things about encaustic is that I don't have to put them under glass.
Yeah, I use I either have a, you know, wrapped around canvas or a floating frame. I mean, you don't want to put encaustic, because the beauty about that too is, as Lucinda said, is you can sometimes, when people see my work, I'll say to them, touch it. Just go ahead and touch it. I want you to feel that surface, and I want you to smell it. And the minute they smell it and touch it, it becomes something real to them. They'll say, oh, I can smell the beeswax. And you can, you know, and you could buff it because it's permanent, it's archival. And it'll last, and I tell them, it will last forever. It's an archival piece. It's a profound, it's an incredible medium to me. And it's, when you talk about history, what, you know, how you came about to encaustic, I was an artist long before I was a beekeeper, and then a beekeeper long before I became an encaustic artist. And you talk about museums. And actually what turned me on to encaustic is when I went to an exhibit in Woodstock, there was an encaustic exhibit there, and I looked at it, and I heard about it. I heard about encaustic painting. And when I saw this exhibit, I was so moved by the medium, and I said, I need to do this, because I, too, was not happy. I was in the corporate world for about 37 years. I was an artist when I was a child. Then I got into the corporate world for 37 years, and I put my paintbrushes away. Mm. Everything gone. Never touched a paintbrush. Okay, nothing. Didn't have time for it. And when I retired 10 years ago, I retired from Columbia Green Community College. I was the director of admissions there. Everybody bought me art material, equipment, easels, pens, brushes. I was equipped. It sat there for a year. I couldn't get back into it. There was nothing that moved me. I felt in that dead space. Got back into photography because I love that. And it was actually, you know, I joined a club, got to meet people, it enticed me. I started doing photography. And then I went to a show in Woodstock and I saw the combination of photo and caustic, and it just blew me away. And I said, I need to do this.
I also want to mention, because I know a lot of people who talk about how they get stuck in their art form. Mm. And the hardest thing is that moment of inertia.
Oh, boy.
You know, like anything, like a car. It's like if it's at a total standstill, it takes a lot of energy to get it going. You used your photography, and you got the wheels to start moving again.
Started to move.
And once they start moving. So I really encourage people, if they feel, because I know so many people who talk to me about this, if they feel like they're not satisfied, they're not moving, jump outside of your box. It's like it's a little frightening because you don't know what's going to happen when you turn the corner. But it's really exciting because you don't know what's going to happen when you turn the corner.
Yeah, exactly.
And I also want to mention before I forget that there is a new collage magazine coming out.
Oh.
It's called Faba. It's from Manhattan. I believe that one of the key people may be coming to my show. I'm hoping that she will. because collage in itself is, I think, a little underappreciated.
Yeah, it is.
You know, people kind of, and then when you think about artists like mm-hmm. Romare Bearden, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I've gone to the museum at the Met and stared at his work endlessly.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little kid when I got turned on to him.
Right.
I mean, he's just fabulous.
Fabulous.
And he's an accepted artist, mm-hmm. but in general, there's been a sort of, once upon a time it was photography.
Yes.
Well, if it was photography, it couldn't be fine art. Now it's a little bit like that with collage. Well, if it's collage, it's, I don't know, it's a little crafty. There's this idea that it's gone into the craft world, like making a wreath, instead of being in the fine art world, like painting, you know, the Mona Lisa.
Right. Well, describe or define collage.
I don't know where the French word comes from, but, you know, what it is it's you take various elements and you make it into something anew.
Right. Merge them.
Somehow you take, you know, it could be anything. Mm-hmm. You take, you know, they can be mm-hmm. found objects. Mm-hmm. They can mm-hmm. be scraps of paper. Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. can be your mother's shoes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mm-hmm. really matter what it is. What matters is that the artist somehow has gathered a series of elements that were once not related
right.
and made them into something that now are a cohesive whole.
Could that be called also mixed art?
Yeah.
Mixed art?
Yes.
Sure.
That's mixed media. That's also mixed media. And the beauty with collage and caustic and beeswax, it just binds it. I mean, if you put that into beeswax, it's there. It's just it just envelopes it. It just, you know, surrounds it, and it's beautiful. I don't know about you, Lucinda, but I find that when I'm working with encaustics and I'm talking about found objects, it's like sculpting also, because you're getting in there and that wax is warm and you're putting collage materials in there. You're putting collage, whether it's photographs or whether it's buttons or whatever it is. You're actually sculpting because the wax is still a little warm. You know, my fingers might go in there and press something or make a movement. The other thing is the heat gun also, because you're using a heat gun to move some of the wax around. It actually, like a paintbrush, you know, I'm able to kind of move that wax, that colored wax, and
right.
and get it, it's almost esoteric. It's beautiful. So you've got the sculpting aspect of it. You've got, you know, collaging with it. You've got the beautiful effect that it has when it's finished, that luminosity, but yet it still has that three-dimensional, it has a three-dimensional look to it, and it's got depth, and it's wonderful.
So, yes, I want to go back to that idea of mixed media and collage for a moment.
Good.
Because there's all kinds of ways of being mixed media. Somebody could say they're mixed media, mm-hmm. and they could be using watercolor and oil paint and acrylic. So collage is, I think, a little, mm-hmm. it's a little different than that insofar. Mm-hmm. It's a mixed media collage. I think that's what we do.
I think I define a lot of my pieces that way, mixed media collage.
And I actually, you know, on my website, mm-hmm. and we both have websites that we're going to mention, on my website, I literally list what it is. It's a collage, it's an encaustic, and it's oil paint. Because I think that people, when they read mixed media collage, it's like, well, what is it? Because they want to know if I'm going to invest money in this, if I'm interested in this piece, is it going to last? Or is it going to decay?
Right.
I guess people worry about that, and they should.
There's I want to mention a project that I was one of the award recipients, the Columbia County the New York State Council of the Arts. I was their Columbia County recipient of the Individual Tier Award in 2012, and my project was launched in 2013, where all my 20 pieces are photo and caustic, but it's collage. Hmm. It's all found objects, so it is mixed media collage, and that. The whole project itself was, because I had to do a lot of research and documentation. This is a story, a photo documentary story of a young woman's journey from Eastern Poland in 1939, her deportation to Siberia, and then in labor camps, Siberian labor camps, and then her freedom and travel through Persia, and then through India, and across the sea to Mexico, refugee camp, and then ultimately her resettlement in the United States, and she lives here in Columbia County. So there was this whole research that I had to do for photographs, too. I mean, I went through Ancestry.com. I did everything you can imagine, but I found some amazing photographs that I probably would not have found hadn't I been forced to do that. Mm. And the whole series of work is taken from these photographs and collaged with old lace and barbed wire and, you know, everything to, and old wood, you know, everything to depict that moving moment of that particular time and place, that, you know, whether she was in Siberia or on a cattle train or she was in the deserts of Iran, Persia at that time. So,
what a story.
Yeah, it's an incredible story.
How old is she now?
She's 87. She's alive. She's 87. And it's a story that, it's a family story. It's very moving. A lot of people didn't know about what happened to Eastern Poland at that time. They knew about Western Poland being taken, but they didn't know about Eastern Poland. Mm-hmm. And they were, and the people, there was actually 1,500,000 Poles that were taken in Eastern Poland to Siberian labor camps. And that was kind of hidden from the world at the time. But as a child, I heard that story all my life, and I needed to get it out on paper. When I became this encaustic artist and I heard about the grant, I said, oh, my goodness, this is a great photo documentary, and I've got to do this. So it's going to be shown. I have to get it on the road. I've been laid back. I've been so busy with the Council of the Arts. I'm on their board of directors that I've got to make it my project to get it out there next year. But it's been launched.
Is that what your show is going to be next year?
Yeah. I've got to get it out there. It was launched at Columbia Green Community College. We had over about 125 people come to the presentation. It was a presentation and exhibit. And it's going to be back at the college because they asked me to bring it back. And they want it up for a while. So it's going to be there in November of this year.
How large are your pieces?
The largest piece is 16 by 20. They're smaller pieces. Something that I need to be challenged with. I heard you talking about you're working with larger pieces, and something that I need to work with.
Yeah, I've gone, you know, I'm going to have some pieces that are very small. It's what I'm actually working on right now is one large piece and a whole bunch of smaller pieces.
Yeah, that's what this exhibit.
So I've got some that are 6 by 6.
Yep.
But, there's some that are 42 by 27.
Okay.
So, and of course, since you know the wax, it becomes a different kind of challenge.
Absolutely.
When
it dries very quickly.
Right. When you're slinging that kind of wax and you got big pieces you're moving around.
You got to move fast.
You've got to move really, really fast. So you have to know exactly where that piece, that's
absolutely.
Why I use the patterns.
Absolutely.
So I have to know exactly where it's going to land.
Right.
I don't have time to fool around.
Absolutely. Yeah, because what happens, like, you know, even 16 by 20s, I had to, you know, there were some pieces in there that where I... you know, I printed on rice paper, 16 by 20 rice paper, and then I dipped that into the wax, and I had to move very quickly and get that out of the wax and into the warm canvas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have to be very focused, no interruptions, and when it lands, because rice paper, you just can't, you rip
no,
that out,
you
got to start all
rip.
Over again.
Right.
It's not like a photographic paper where, okay, I'll take it out and put it back in.
Yeah, I'm using watercolor paper.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that's too thick for me. I need rice because I like the translucency of the rice paper. You can overlap one on top of another, and it almost looks, has a ghostly effect. So, and I needed that ghostly effect for this project because it's all about Holocaust survivors. And actually, one of the pieces right now is at the National Association of Women Artists in New York City. I was just accepted as a member, and the induction is actually next week in New York. But one of the pieces that I chose to send there was from my Holocaust series, and that was of the children in the death camps. And you just see layers of children, their heads. Mm. And
that's beautiful.
And I think you might
haunting.
Have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very haunting. That's the word that a lot of people describe it. And when I know it moves them and they use that adjective, I said, that's the piece. It worked. So that's there now. But it's that layering of the different photographic pieces on top of each other that just makes for that really transparent feel.
How thick can an acoustic be?
Mm.
How far have you gone?
Let's see. The thickest I've made it so far was at the Woodstock. The Birdcliff Woodstock Guild has a auction every year. They'll actually be having it again. I can't remember the date. It's the 5x7 show. And so all the artists donate a piece, and it raises funds for them. People, if you're lucky, you sell that piece that day, number one, for $100. Nobody gets to sign their work. And last year I did a piece, and I think the whole thing was encaustic, but there were parts of it that were probably I want to say about an inch high.
Yeah.
Wow. And then parts that were very sculptural.
Yeah.
Because I also work as a sculpting assistant. So it just seemed like if, you know, I wanted to play. I mean, that's the great thing about the wax is that you get to play. I want to mention while I'm thinking about it, a little bit about what my upcoming show is about.
Please.
And why I'm so excited about it. Basically, it is, you know, we're at a point in our lives, we're in a point on this planet where I think we really need to get back to some of our deeper aspects of what makes us a human being. So then, of course, I've always been very interested in mythology and the archetypes of the human experience. So I've taken those archetypes and I've made all these pieces addressing that in some way. Some of them are very clear. That, you know, some of them there's male energy, there's female energy. There's a couple with hands. As I started out, I did one piece with hands, and people were so excited by it that then I wound up thinking, you know, just think about it. Mm-hmm. Think about our hands are so expressive.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't even need to see the body. The hands will tell you everything.
True.
So that went off, but they're also very archetypical. So I'm trying to have a dialogue about our deeper significance here on the planet and who we really are. I'm not so interested with the persona that we carry with us every day as I am with who are you inside? What moves you? And I've been told, you know, this is my pet peeve, I'm sorry. This is not New York art. This is not, you have to go to the West Coast to show this art.
Mm.
It's like, really, why do you have to be, what is it that makes it so the West Coast is interested in a deeper, they're more open to a more deeper experience, but on the East Coast, they want something that is a more mental construct. And I think that too long we have been looking at the world like that.
Mm.
And there's got to be a way to merge that reality together. It can't be either or. It has to be both. It has to be, you have to be able to use your intuition and your mental faculties. There shouldn't be the West Coast is for, you know, a stick of incense and the East Coast is for Wall Street. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me.
It's about culture. That's what defines us, unfortunately.
And that's why I've been using those old myths, because we have built our cultures, you know, on those myths.
Absolutely.
So let's go back to them, because they were trying to talk to us about something.
Right.
And I don't think, you know, we may have evolved and have great technology, but I don't know how much truly we've evolved inside.
Yeah.
I think we've had such a division in so many ways between the left brain and the right brain. And because of that, I think we can all see that there are some serious issues that we're dealing with on the planet. But perhaps if each one of us can have an inner revolution where we can take those bits and put them together into one holistic working person, we might be able to solve these problems a lot quicker.
I agree. You know, I'm thinking here about the planet, what you're talking about. I'm thinking about the wax, and it goes back to the bees. They are our biggest indicator, too, of what's happening with our planet.
It's been horrible what's been going on with the bees.
It's very scary. And, you know, it's funny. The bees were my... When I started beekeeping, it was because I wanted to help the bees. And I mean, they're our food source, if you think about it. You know, there's signs on everybody's car, no farm, no food, no bees, no food, no farms. So, but they are an indication of what's happening, too. I started out, I'm not in the beekeeping for my art. That's a secondary. I'm in the beekeeping to increase our bee population. I'm not in it for even the honey. It comes as, you know, a secondary thing. But they are an indication of what's happening with our environment, too.
Did you get affected? I know some people had a bee fungus.
No, I didn't. I've been very fortunate, and I don't want to say that I'm going to run out of luck or anything. I've been very fortunate each year to have my bees come through the winter, but I have not had that fungus, and I've not had that varroa mite infestation. I've been very lucky to pull 90% of my hives through each winter, but every winter is different. Nothing can be... You know, we can't predict what's going to happen, but mm-hmm. they are, you know, we need to listen to the environment for sure.
Do bees have predators?
Sure. The big in the insect world or the man world, man is their biggest predator because of the pesticides that is being put on plants, on crops. In the insect world, you're not going to believe it, but it's the dragonfly. The dragonfly is their biggest predator. Actually, I have 10 acres and I have a beautiful pond and streams, and I have dragon and I have fields of rye in front of the BR, the apiary. And there's beautiful, absolutely gorgeous dragonflies just flying around waiting for the right time to catch the right bee that's coming, you know, the beehives that are coming out of the beehives. But that's their biggest predator. But man is on top of that one.
Big time.
We're the biggest predator for almost everything. We talk about the East Coast and the West Coast. Even the almond growers, when they're shipping out these bees over to California.
Well, it's a big money business,
Money business, and they're shipping them in tractor trailers, and they're talking about colony collapse, and they're talking about that's stressful for the bees to ship them out like that for, you know, 6 weeks and then bring them back, and it's a tough life for a bee. It really is. But there are very few feral bees out there, you know. They're very few. And if you can find one, then that's great. You know, when I have a swarm and it takes off and I can't catch it, I just wish it lots of luck and hope that it makes it, because we need the feral bees also.
Well, tell a life story of a bee. I'm kind of curious.
Oh, my gosh. You know, there's only, you know, in the beehive, all worker bees are females. I don't know if everybody knows that. You have the drones that come in through the spring. It's unfertilized egg. And actually, this time of the season, the drones are all kicked out. You'll go to the hives, you'll see all the little boys are all kicked out. They're just a high risk to the hive. But the bee, there's one queen. Each colony, I have 16 hives, and each colony is very much individualized. They're not all the same. And one bee can't cross over to another colony. They know where they belong.
Hmm.
Oh, yes. And it develops from the queen laying the egg, fertilized egg, and develops into a pupa, and then into it. You know, it's fed royal jelly by the house bees. The bees have stages that they go through. They come out when there's about 21 days for them to emerge, and they come out, and they are actually, their first chore is to clean. So they clean their area, they become house bees. And then they become, they also feed and clean the queen. So they're very much house retainers. Then they get a little older and they become guard bees. They go out there just checking, making sure no other bees from other places or wasps or anything invades. And then the foragers are your adult bees. They're the bees that will go out and collect the nectar. And their lifespan during the summer is about 6 weeks, because they actually work themselves to death. Yeah. But the queen can lay close to 1,500 eggs a day. So you can see that the evolvement of the bee inside the beehive is very rapid. And this is why you have swarms, because a swarm is all about overpopulation. You know, just too many bees. She's done her job. She's doing a good job. And now the hive has to be split in half. So they all know this. They send out pheromones to each other that it's time that the hive is overcrowded and it needs to divide itself. And what will happen is the queen bee, they'll stop feeding the queen bee, the matriarch of the hive. They'll stop feeding her so that she'll be able to fly, because she's really very heavy with food and eggs. So they'll stop feeding her for a while. The pheromones will go out. And they'll build themselves what they call it. The worker bees will build queen cells, which looks like little peanut shells at the end of a frame. They'll build about 7 or 8 of them for insurance policies. And in those queen cells, an emerging bee, every one of those larvae in those queen cells has a potential of becoming a queen. And what makes a difference is they feed the larva only royal jelly. Hot stuff. So when they're all developing,
which, may I add, is very good for you as well.
Yes, it's good stuff. Good stuff. And what will happen is the first queen that emerges will send out a hooting sound, and you can actually, sometimes I was lucky to hear that. And I know that I'm having a swarm, by the way. And they will send out a hooting sound to the other queens, and they'll kill the other queens. Mm. So then you have a new virgin queen, but in the meantime, the the current queen that was there will then take off with her half of her hide, and that's what the swarm is about. The bees will all fill their stomach with honey, and they'll go and find a new home, and they have scouts to do that. Okay, so that's a development of a bee from the larva to, you know, the pupa to an emerging bee to the different roles that an actual bee will have. And one question everyone asks me, what do bees do in the winter? Do they die? Do they hibernate? They're very much alive. They actually form a cluster, and inside that cluster is the queen. And just like the penguins, they'll move around, you know, in the cold, because the temperature inside the hive is just as cold as the temperature outside the hive. But what they'll do is form that cluster. And when I take a winter walk, which I do all the time, because I check on my hives every day, is I'll put my ear to the hive and I can hear the humming inside, just a slight hum. And I know they're in there and they're okay. But when I don't hear that hum, something's wrong. So
who makes that wax?
Bees do.
And how do they and why do they make this lovely wax you're both using?
Wow. They actually make propolis. There's three. They have a honey stomach. There's two stomachs in a bee. They have a honey stomach, and they also make propolis, honey, and wax. And propolis is very medicinal, and it comes from the sap of trees. Actually, the ones that make the wax are the younger bees, the bees that come out. And they have this wax excrement, and they make this wonderful substance.
Are they unhappy with you removing that wax?
You know, every hive, I said, it depends on the hive because they all have their own personality. I have some hives that you have to have a lot of smoke to get into the hive. And I have a guard bee chasing me right back to the house. Then there's some hives that I can go in there with just a little puff of smoke and go in there and move the frames around. No one likes to have their honey stored. That's like me coming to your house and taking food out of your refrigerator, taking everything out of your cupboard. Nobody wants to have their food taken from them. So they're all going to be moderately annoyed. Okay. And what I do is, and the minute you start moving a frame and you take one frame out full of wax and honey, it's full of sealed, it's called sealed honey. They are very, very annoyed, and they start buzzing around you, and you need to have a veil on, and you need to have a smoker on. So they're pretty, the aggressiveness varies from each hive. Some hives I could have 16, 20 bees on my mask, you know, on my veil. Other hives, they're just flying around, just waiting for me to leave. So,
and Lucinda, you're not getting the wax like Maria, but where do you get your wax?
I get my wax at R&F and Caustic. That's where I've gotten, I would say, 90% of the materials. Well, maybe 80% of the materials that I'm using for the new show. And I also want to mention there, I also have paintings from the rest of my life, because I don't know if you've ever been to Nobo Gallery, but to me it seems as large as Macy's. So although I have worked up a whole new show for this opening, there will also be oil paintings exhibited. I buy my things at R&F. They're just, their supplies are wonderful.
Yeah.
And I can buy huge bags of what's in caustic medium, which is Damar and beeswax. It's not just beeswax anymore. They've literally mixed it up for me. And it can come in bricks. I get it in these itty-bitty little pellets, and only because it melts faster. I used to get it in the bricks, put it in the freezer, take it out of the freezer, beat it with the hammer, watch it explode, and then melt it. But now it's just easier for me. I'm using so much.
The other thing I think we both didn't talk about is we need to put resin also into the wax. That will harden
it.
Right,
that's what I just mentioned, the Damar.
The Damar resin, it's very important to put it. And, you know, the Damar resin is like, how much water do you put into that flower? Because Damar resin is almost like how much you put Damar resin is almost an artist's choice. The more you put in, the harder it will be. So it's a matter of choice, but you definitely need to put that in to harden it somehow.
If you look at it online, you'll see that there's a lot of different formulas.
Yeah.
Different artists have very different opinions, as you said, on how hard they want their wax to be.
And where is R&F?
It's... I can't remember the name of the street, but it's
Tenbrook.
There you go.
Tenbrook Street in Kinston. It's actually the only one.
Near the railroad tracks.
Yeah, it's the only one on the East Coast like this. They ship their wax all over the country. I mean, this is an amazing...
I don't remember Richard's last name right now, but he's a sweetheart, and he started the company.
Yeah.
It's a local business. Support your local businesses.
Right.
You know, I know, I've gone in there so many times in the last few months buying hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of wax that every time I go in now, they're like, what are you doing? And I'm so looking forward to dropping off my invitation to them so they can finally see at least something of what I've been doing.
You definitely should.
Yeah, I'm
definitely
going to.
Should. It's a wonderful place. They have a beautiful, they have a nice gallery. They show, you know, encaustic artist works. They have a great studio. Actually, I did take a class from R&F Studio, but another person that I took a class from, I don't know if you know her, Jill Burkholder. She's an encaustic artist, and she does bromoil. And I took a weekend crash course with her, and I always take a weekend crash course with her because she's over in Palenville. She's worth, oh my God, she's been my mentor. And the other one, you talk about collage, I took a course from Lynn Perella, who is a collage master. She's in that.
She is very good.
She's actually got a show right now down at the Chamber of Commerce, or it's coming up. So you might want to see that. She another weekend class with her, because I believe, even though I'm somewhat of, I don't know about you, but I had some formal training, but I don't hold a degree in art. You know, a lot of it's self-taught, but a lot of it's crash courses with the masters. And they have taught me a lot. And the crash course with bees was my aunt in Poland, when I went to visit Poland. I had an 82-year-old aunt who was beekeeping, and I said, oh my God, I gotta do this. And she took me through a day with her of beekeeping, and I said, this is unbelievable. So, you know, the teaching is with great masters too, and self-taught, and as you said, stepping out of the box too, being able to experiment and not be afraid of what's gonna, you know, what's gonna come out of it, because something is gonna come out of it, whether it's a learning lesson all the time.
Lucinda, did you tell us the title or the what your exhibition is called?
No, I didn't bring that up. It's called The Gathering of the Tribes.
Oh, that's a great name.
And I called it that for any, or it told me to call it that for any number of reasons. First of all, as I mentioned, there's I've pulled from all different aspects of mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So to see all these different storied characters all together, I mean, when I think about it, I get goosebumps. I think it's going to be very strong. But there were other reasons. It's just before Thanksgiving. And what do we do at Thanksgiving? But, you know, we gather together. It's the light is lessening. And so we seek the comfort of each other. So I wanted to do that. I also, you know, every day when I wake up, I bow to the four directions and express my gratitude. And every day at dusk, I do the same thing all over again. Only usually I do that as I'm driving down this very windy, windy road. There's a lake there, and I start at the beginning of all the winding, and I end at this weeping willow tree, and then I send it off into the water. The tree to me is the witness to it all. That's always my last thing, and thank you for the witness. So I wanted a place, like I said, it's Thanksgiving. I wanted to pull together the archetypes. I wanted to pull together, there's so many people coming to the show, if it doesn't storm. And some I know from Facebook. I mean, I have met some incredible artists through Facebook that I just, photographers and collage artists and painters and writers. Facebook has really been a boon to me artistically. There's every day I find something that someone has posted that blows my mind artistically.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I
totally
just,
agree with that.
It's really, you know, I'm no longer a lonely painter sitting in a box of paints. There's a whole world of artists out there.
So
a great many of those people that I've never met physically are coming, and some of them are coming from, one of them's coming from Virginia Beach, and she's actually going to be helping me. She's coming early.
Oh,
We've never physically met. Mm. Mm. She's a photographer. But I just feel, I have always felt such a kindredship with her. And then people are coming from Manhattan. I think somebody's coming from Boston. People are coming from way further up north in New York. It's really a gathering of the tribes, because what do these people all have in common?
Right.
Me.
It's your vision, too. It's how you projected that in the vision that you have. It's come to fruition.
I think these people have been, I mean, that's the other thing. And I won a Rauschenberg Award. I had a show on 57th Street. I've worked for some of the who's who of American artists and sculpting. I mean, when you said, how did I learn? Of course, I was thinking, yes, I went to school, but I've been very fortunate that really I have worked for the masters.
Yeah.
And each one of them has given me some kind of gift that I have for my own. I worked for a short time for Mary Frank, and she does some collage work. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the gathering of the tribes, I think it's going to be really a very deep and meaningful experience, not just for me. Of course, it will be for me, and I will be bringing hankies because I know I'll cry. But I think it's going to affect people.
Right.
I really, truly, I brought one image into the Woodstock framing, the art store, the office and art store, to get framed. And because the frames I bought, nothing was working. And they were very kind. They're going to frame it for me. But when I left, people were really clustered around it. And so it's partly the material, because they do touch it. You can't help but touch this stuff. So people were like touching it, but they were also like, because I find, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, there's a moment I'm fusing, I've painted, I've got all these layers, I've got the oil paint on top, I'm using the heat gun, and I'm going over it, there's a glistening, and at that then there's the glistening, and then I literally, because the wax molecules are lighter than the oil molecules.
Right.
So the wax molecules, literally, you watch them. They come up and they grab. They're like cousins to the oil paint. And so they grab onto the oil paint and it changes it.
They embrace it.
Yeah. I mean, they really do. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, cousin, it's so good to see you again.
Right.
It's so fast. I mean, this happens in seconds. And you can't, like she said, Maria said, if you use the heat gun, you can move your work around. I mean, just like a crazy paintbrush.
It's a paintbrush.
Yeah.
It acts as a paintbrush. And there's different heat guns, too. And there's the brush. There are the little tiny pens, too, that you can also work with if you want to work with much more finer, smaller detail, the heat pens. But you're right. It's quite an experience.
I can tell both of you really enjoy doing your art.
Oh, I've never been more happier. I really have never been more happier. I've started out as a child as a plein air artist. Actually, here my parents moved up here from New Jersey. We bought a farm. They bought a 90 acre farm. There was a gentleman, an artist in Hudson, Victor Dowling, Dowling. He taught classes, plein air classes, and so I was always a plein air artist. And then I went off to art school and. You know, it was good, but never really quite as crazy passionate as I am now. I'm just so in love with what I'm doing. And, you know, I could see it in your face, too, Lucinda. You're very happy when you talk about your project. And I'm happy when I talk about my project. When you talk about being moved, the same thing happened when I unveiled the Forgotten Holocaust. It was a woman, you know, she walks amongst us because that was the story. There are people that walk among us every day in our lives, sit next to us, that have profound stories to tell. You took your passion and your thoughts and put it on canvas. And if it moves, when I walk away from my work, if it moves me, I will not leave that canvas alone unless it moves me. If it moves me, my work moves me, then I know it's going to move someone else. And that's the end result. It's got to move me. It's got to make me feel, wow, this is really good. I feel great about it.
You know, I work from a very intuitive place. I often don't, it's going to sound so crazy, I often don't know what's going on.
You don't.
And I'm not stoned. I'm perfectly straight. I maybe too much caffeine sometimes. but I really don't. There'll be all these twists and turns mm-hmm. inside the visual, and it tells me it's done.
Yeah.
I just know. And I think when I was young, my problem really was that I overworked pieces. Like, I didn't know to stop. So I would just keep going and going. And you could work on one painting for the rest of your life.
Right.
It would never end. So, but now it's like as you get older, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's a sculptor who I worked for in the city some time ago. And, you know, I'm an older human being. I'm not old yet, but I'm middle aged. And he's selling work. Many of the artists I know are selling work. Everybody seems to be happy and productive. And he said, it's a very interesting because we have less energy actually than we used to, but we have a much greater skill set. So you come to the table now. I certainly am coming to the table with a wide variety of flavors of knowledge. And I think there's something really satisfying about sitting down with your material when you have the confidence. Because when you don't have confidence, you halt, you hesitate. But once you have that confidence, you're just in a flow. You're in a flurry of activity.
Yeah, and it's a lot different than painting a plein air or still life, too. When you talk about, I don't know where I'm not stoned. I don't know where I'm coming from. I don't know how. I feel the same way when I do that, when I work with my piece, because it's not looking at a landscape and painting it and put it on your canvas, or a still life or a portrait or whatever. You've got 150 cutout pieces there. What are you going to do with it? And you got a palette, a blank palette, and what are you going to do with it? You got all these wonderful colors, and what are you going to... And in your mind, you see this vision. And you're right. You're not quite sure how it's going to turn out. But it starts to develop. And that's what I say. When the end result, when it starts to develop, and you have a piece that moves you, you've come to the right place.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. Like I said, I've done some CD covers now. I've done some music posters. And I mean, that's an interesting thing because, I have a goal.
Yeah.
You know, I have to produce something. Somebody just asked me a couple days ago if I would do something for his CD. And I said, well, send me some photographs and, let's see where we go. But you have a goal in mind. I have a very specific bit of information that I have to get out, or otherwise the artist who's hiring me is going to be not very happy with me, and I won't feel like I fulfilled my obligation to help them visually, because that's why they're turning to me. So like with the work that I'm doing here, I have like an idea. I know what myth I'm going to portray, and I literally sit down, I light incense and I call them to me. That's what I do. I say, please use me. And that starts a journey. And I don't know, like I said, there 60 pieces will get cut out. 30, 40 will get used. Then it gets big. Then I cut it all up again. Some of them get used. Some of them don't get used. I change it again. And then I'm adding all these other paint. I'm adding paint, infusing the paint. You can't really tell. And then I'm painting on top of the piece. You can't tell what's going on anymore. It used to be with my old collages, if you ran your hand on it, you could see where I had painted it. But with these, you really don't know, which is both good and bad. I've heard that people want a more that argument again, if they want something that's less controlled. And my work is controlled. It's not. I'm not haphazardly going at anything.
No, I never felt that at all with that. I agree with you. I think there's a lot of control in what you're doing. I mean, you're not quite sure what it's going to be, but that doesn't mean you don't have control over it.
Maria, what is your website, and how do we find more of your work?
My website is, I'm at www.mariakz.com. And right now I'm in a variety of different places. I'm going to be showing, hopefully, again, I'm going to be showing at the Columbia County Chamber of Commerce this year. I haven't set a date for that. My work is down at the Columbia County Council of the Arts because I'm on I'm actually the gallery director there, but right now we have a show there, Colors of Columbia County. One of my pieces is there. And actually, it's not an encaustic. It's an oil painting, believe it or not.
Maria, I'm going to interrupt just to ask you to spell your website because somebody might not know how to spell
that. Good point. It's Maria, M-A-R-I-A-K-Z as in zebra, .com. Thanks for clarifying that. It's a good thing I don't have to spell my last name, though, right? actually, I'm donating a piece this coming weekend to the Columbia Green Foundation auction. One of my pieces will be going in there as donation. I'm going to be hopefully showing at the Woodstock Artists Association. I've been showing there. And one of the things I think I said to Lucinda, my goal this year is to get my work out there more because I've been so busy with the Council of the Arts and the artists there, which I absolutely love working there, promoting their works, that I'm going to have to kind of pull back my reins a little bit and get my own stuff going out there because I've been with the Farm Tour, the Columbia County Plein Air Group, been there, sold several pieces there at Highland Farms. I don't have a current exhibit right now, but you will see my exhibit very soon, hopefully, the end in November at Columbia Green Community College, and that's The Forgotten Holocaust.
And Lucinda?
As I mentioned, I will be November 15th on a Saturday, will be my opening reception at Nobo Gallery, 558 Warren Street in lovely downtown Hudson. I'll also be, I've been asked to give some talks and show some work at Georgia Tech. That'll be sometime in 2015. I held off on it because I said I got to get through the show before I know what I'm doing next, please. I am an active member at the Woodstock Artists Association. Mm. So, you know, this will be a solo show. I had a solo show
wonderful.
There as well. And as I mentioned, the Burcliffe Woodstock Guild, they have the 5x7 show, and every year I do a piece. I have not yet done my piece, and I know it's due.
Well, you've been busy.
Soon after opening, but I have enough time that I can still do it. Yeah, so I just got asked to do somebody's CD cover, so we'll see if that comes through.
And we were talking about websites. Do you have a website?
I do indeed have a website. Thank you for asking me. My website is abraart.com. That's like abracadabra, A-B-R-A-A-R-T, like aardvark, two A's in the middle, abraart.com. And if you go to my website, you'll see that there's different areas. There's an encaustic area where you can see some of, but not all of, the work that's going to be at the show. And if you go to the image and then you double-click it, it'll get much bigger. And then there's a magnifying glass where you can actually even get in deeper into
Wonderful.
The pieces.
We've actually come to the close of the Art of the Hudson Valley.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Maria and Lucinda. Thank you for being on this edition of The Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and this is WGXC 90.7 FM. I want to thank our listeners, and you'll be hearing from us again on the radio. Thank you.